Don't you know we've all got sunken treasures down at the bottom of the blue? But old Poseidon, he can't keep it there forever. 'Cause I can see the gold in you, buried in the sea of me below, hidden in a sailor's chest of oak, in a place where only you would know. Buried in the woods where no one goes, hidden in a sailor's chest of oak, in a place where you and only you can know, could know, could know.
Right, so where was I? I'm not really entirely sure. There's another thing I was going to talk about anyway today, so I'll just go straight into that. Fortunately, I got an echo, so I'm going to take my headphones away completely. I've been watching Deadwood. Rewatching the Deadwood series. And, well, it's sparked some thoughts in me, specifically about culture and the sort of ongoing assumption that I've had that culture is inherently malign and nothing good comes out of culture. And, of course, I've been conflicted about that. That's kind of the point. Why I've been constantly going back to that, because I can't resolve the cognitive dissonance in myself between the awareness of the dark underlayer of culture and my own pleasure that I take in some of the products of culture. And while I was watching Deadwood last night, I felt it was the fourth episode, which the fourth and the fifth episodes. It's the episode, for those who've seen it, in which Wild Bill Hickok, played by Keith Carradine, is killed by a revolting piece of white trash, drunken, deranged, card gambler. Forget who the actor is who plays him. I never did know his name. He reappears, actually, in a later season of Deadwood as a completely different character. It's one of the anomalies in that series. Anyway, and it's a very moving episode, and it's particularly dependent on depicting the love between Wild Bill Hickok and Bullet, played by Timothy Oliphant, and it portrays it in very subtle ways. Well, maybe not very subtle, but for dramatic entertainment, it's subtle. But it's also very unusual, the way it depicts this love between these two men. They don't know each other particularly well, they've only just met, but there's an affinity between them. And it shows through these various different scenes leading up to this point that there's this deepening love between them. And how unusual that is in TV and in movies, and actually how unusual it is for a movie or a TV show to really communicate or transmit love between the characters. And I guess this would be inseparable from the love of the author who's creating those characters. Now, Deadwood is famous justifiably for its dialogue, for its writing by David Milch, it's been called Shakespearean, and I think not wrongly again. It's an outstanding show by any standards. I would say it's easily the best TV show that was ever made that I've seen. But I don't say things like that because that's kind of like saying the best fast food or the most aromatic fart. It seems somehow perverse. Knowing all that I know and having communicated all the things I've communicated in my previous outpourings about culture and how it's all this big incestuous tangle of dark undercurrents and complicities and conspiracies and abuses. So I could deconstruct, I'm sure, Deadwood in terms of a cultural product and find out that people involved had shady affiliations and practices and so on and so forth. I'm not going to do that. Maybe I'd be pleasantly surprised and it would back up what I'm going to say, but I don't think that it can really come down to this. But what I want to say is that I find Deadwood to be a cultural product that is fundamentally wholesome, that actually transmits something that is nourishing and life-enhancing. And that really creates cognitive dissonance. And yet, it is consistent with Valis in the Kibble and my belief, which is much less political or paranoid and more spiritual or mystical, that the Holy Spirit or the transmission or the divine or Paraclete or Christ or God can reach us through absolutely anything, potentially. I mean, I have to kind of put a qualifier on that because this can be taken into the left-hand path of transgression and all kinds of absurdities that aren't true because they're absurd, but are untrue because they're absurd. But essentially, fundamentally, God works in mysterious ways, and the way in which we have an experience of the numinous or the divine isn't limited, I don't think, by the vehicles that we're interacting with, by the forms that we're interacting with. Anyway, so for me, a Deadwood is an example of something that transcends the form and allows for an experience of the formless. Another example would be This Is England, which was a less known show. I think Chris Meadows is the name of the person behind it. I can Google it, find out. Which is about working class kids in Northern England. And that has an astonishing underlayer, Shane Meadows is his name, underlayer of love and humanity and soul to it that isn't obvious on the surface. Like, it's about a bunch of working class kids, even skinheads and nationalists, white nationalists, and the dysfunctional, disaffected, alienated kids. It's not sentimental. Like, Deadwood is not sentimental, almost anti-sentimental, you could say. But again, the fundamental humanity that bleeds through the piece, I think, is transcendental. But I can't be sure that this would be the case for other people. I don't know how this works, and I don't recommend things like this generally because it seems to just reinforce the idea that culture has some good in it, so we just have to sift through and find the good, and when we find the good we can stick with it, and that's more or less what we're doing anyway. That's what fan bases are built around, the belief that things speak to us personally and directly, that they have profound meaning, and that they transcend all the other stuff. So I've kind of generated the belief for myself that there's nothing good in culture. So even the stuff that I really like and I find meaningful, probably I've just been fooled. I've been tricked. So I can recommend it at the level of, if you're going to watch movies and TV anyway, well, watch these. I recommend them. They're good. But I try not to cross the line and say, like I used to, like, this is art, this has something of true value and meaning, and so on, because that would assume that I have the discernment to tell the difference, and that would go against my belief that we've been colonized to the point that our very aesthetic responses have been compromised. So we're kind of interfacing with an advanced form of technology that we mistake not just for magic or for UFO, but for art as well. Like, art itself is this perception managing technology that can fool us. So then it's kind of like the thing I've talked about with hope, of like how to banish false hope. Well, first of all, we just have to let go of the need for hope and just admit to ourselves that possibly we're deluded about all the things that give us hope. So let's just let go of the need to believe in them and let go of the need for hope and just see what happens then. Clear up a space to connect to something real. And if there is a connection, then out of that a true hope is generated. It would be congruent or simultaneous with actually the fulfillment of hope. But of course, unless it was a final fulfillment, like a ultimate enlightenment experience, then it would come and go. So in the interim, we would possibly be developing a new true hope based on those experiences that we've only been able to have in the absence of false hope, in the absence or the cancellation of a need to hope. And so what I've been doing recently with Dave O'Shana is I've been offering up my experience of finding and connecting. I mixed them up and it sounded like conniving there. Finding and connecting to a source of true value, purpose and meaning that thereby provides real hope to me, and I want to share that with others, knowing that it's very risky and that my prior track record of succumbing to the spell of gurus and mystical spiritual teachers and then compulsively deconstructing and exposing the lies that I've succumbed to makes me, in a certain sense, an unreliable narrator, even though one can flip it around and say it makes me more reliable because I've shown my chops for identifying the counterfeit. But it can, you know, it cuts both ways, that sword. And the same then applies to the culture. Like, I've deconstructed pop culture to show that it's a delivery device for toxic ideology. And so I've been very reluctant to say, but there are examples, there are things out there that we can look at that will enrich our lives, even though they look like the same thing. Dave looks like a spiritual teacher. Deadwood looks like a TV show from HBO. Well, it is a TV show from HBO. Doesn't look like any other one, but still coming through the same medium. Just as Dave's coming through the same medium, not just the internet, but the spiritual marketplace, the packaging of the spiritual marketplace is more or less the same. So obviously it's not literally the same. There's a lot more reason to distrust Deadwood, not just because it looks like an HBO TV show, but because it is. Well, as I said, it doesn't look like, but I mean, anyway, never mind. It actually is. It got backed and funded and made by insiders in the entertainment industry. So how could it possibly be good? Well, this is a big question mark. Can something good come out of Babylon? Came out of Bethlehem. And this relates also to the UFO puzzle. I've been wrestling with once again while reading American Cosmic, or rather while writing an analysis of American Cosmic, that it's trying to present the possibility that something good is coming out of all of this massive social engineering and parapolitical narrative weaving and myth making that I've already mapped very carefully with Prisoner Infinity, even with many of the same characters. The suspects are the same. And although, of course, I'm not convinced, I have to say that she's making a convincing case, and so it is causing me to question my own conviction a little bit. Because I can't afford to be convicted. I can't afford to be absolutely convinced of a position about this. I would say any position, really. Because of this weird confusion between the knowledge that culture and society is controlled to the extent that everything within it is compromised, and the faith that the spirit, the divine, the soul, true reality can reach us through all and any means whatsoever. So that's my conundrum. That's the problem that I'm working on now, as always. Look further into your mind and you'll see what really lies for you in there. Could be surprised what you find in the deep dark depths of your wicked land. You try something new, skin in and see what is true. Know how it feels to be used and to gaze into the great eyes of So, I don't know how to tie all this together. I was just looking into American Cosmic, the main source for which is this person that's unnamed, who she refers to as Tyler D after Fight Club. So I was just looking to see if there's been speculation about who this man is. Wiltley Strieber knows who he is. And Wiltley Strieber, I just listened to an interview with Pasulka that he did recently, and he talks about how Tyler has done amazing things for humanity, things that all of us have benefited from. The second part of the interview with Pasulka that Strieber didn't air. He just does a solo show talking about the book, and he claims that the reason it didn't air was that after they'd recorded it, some of Pasulka's sources told her that she had crossed the line and she had talked about things that she wasn't supposed to talk about, and so they weren't permitting her to air it. And I found this very suspect, to say. It didn't add up, and I'm not sure I can quite say how or why it didn't, but it just doesn't seem credible somehow. Or at the very least, it infers that Pasulka is working for her sources. Because Strieber said that neither he nor her knew exactly what they'd said that wasn't allowed to be shared. So if Pasulka and Strieber are just discussing the things in the book and speculating and so on, then how is it that somehow crosses a line into divulging things that are not supposed to be divulged? How is it possible that Pasulka could possibly let slip something that she wasn't supposed to share without knowing it? It doesn't make sense. She would know if it was some information that she had left out of the book that she had mistakenly shared with Strieber. She would know that. So then that could only mean that it was rather just as they were riffing that they ended up getting into areas of speculation that hit upon too close to the truth. And then it doesn't make sense for her to be censored for doing that, because that could happen at any time, anywhere. So it's more a question of they didn't like it for whatever reason, and so they said, you can't air it. So really it's an admission that Strieber and Pasulka are working for the sources, I think. As I say, it's not entirely clear. It never is in this field. It never is. But anyway, I haven't seen anything at a first glance that's going to reveal who this Tyler D is. Maybe a red herring. But I find it is a problem, a cognitive problem for me personally, to reconcile again what I know about the networks of manipulation, exploitation and abuse, deception, distortion, in which these narratives are embedded, or which they're emerging from, with the kind of claims that Pasulka is making in American Cosmic that seem essentially benign, with the idea that some of these insider scientists, researchers, and even perhaps political, even intelligence agents, are genuinely working for the good, or genuinely believe that they are. I suppose that latter is not so hard to get my head around, that they might genuinely believe that. I think that that's the only way to reconcile it. The nature of the counterfeit is that it persuades people that it's real, and then they will spread it, they will reproduce it, they will even copy it, thinking that they're making copies of something real, but they're just making copies of a counterfeit. And it becomes harder and harder thereby to gauge what is the counterfeit, or what makes the counterfeit counterfeit, based on the sincerity of the individuals or even the apparent benevolence of the individuals. Like, what constitutes benevolence, I think, is probably the ultimate question here. And I got into this with my conversation with Scrouse yesterday, which I think I'm going to air for the 200th Liminalist, because I wanted that to be a kind of memorable one, just because numbers have some meaning. And so it won't be strictly in sequence, because I have a couple more to air that came before that. But anyway, my conversation with Scrouse, we talk about the desire to make a world a better place or to help people. And if that's separate from the simple orientation towards enjoyment, to doing what is deeply satisfying to us in our souls, then we probably aren't helping anyone and we probably aren't making the world a better place. If we have an idea about this, that it's something we need to do or that we want to do, and that we can know what will work, then we're probably not referring to a very deep part of our being, because I don't think that it works that way. I don't think that anything in nature pursues its nature or embodies its nature as a means to help or as a means to make the world a better place. I think that that's the cart before the horse syndrome. I think that it's only when we're fully in tune with our nature, fully enjoying the experience of being embodied and of experiencing and sharing love for being here, that we can act in such a way that is helpful. And that brings me back to Deadwood. The sense there is of what's being communicated in that show, what's present in it, is this very deep transmission or representation of love. The characters in the episodes I'm speaking of specifically, Wild Bill and Seth Bullock, this deep love and affinity between them, which is communicated in very simple, brief, subtle ways. It's not a big Disney trumpet fanfare, Titanic, angels singing thing. It's gritty, it's dirty, it's in the mud literally, it's full of cursing, but there's a look here, a smile there, a nod there, an acknowledgement of human fallibility and weakness, an expression of compassion that resonates that much more profoundly for being in the context of something real. Of course, I recognize the irony of that. It's not real. It's a TV show. But it's a TV show that I would say that the dedication to recreating realistic detail, characters, performances, dialogue, is what creates the manure, if you will, from which the flowers of love transmission can bud, can emerge. That's the necessary context in which love happens. And it can only be sourced, as I say, in the love of the author, the creative people, the actors, all that, immersed in this creative process that brings something together, human beings together, but also something within the individual humans comes into form and into connection together. So in the episode, the preacher talks about the hand. If the hand wants to be if the hand says it's not a foot, does that therefore mean it's not part of the body? That speech from the gospel about how the body works together, and although there are parts that we consider less worthy or less sacrosanct, they're all equally essential. There's something in Deadwood that represents that. All the parts are represented with equal love. So the counterpart to the love between Bill and Bullock is in that episode is the love between Al, the saloon owner, played by Ian McShane, who's a really reprehensible character, but at the same time, you can't help but love him. And Ebi, the hotel owner. Like, there is love between those two also, but they're filth. They're slime. They're scoundrels. They're up to no good. And they're genuinely committing or trying to commit or complicit with evil. But there is love between them. And so they're not reduced to cardboard caricatures of evil any more than Bullock and Bill are reduced to cardboard caricatures of good. It's all one fabric. It's one world. It's one humanity. And there is not a huge gulf between them. And it's that consistency of compassionate eye, that brings the characters to life, and so it animates them with the transmission, soul transmission of us. Yeah, that's the creators, but it's also us, the audience, receiving it. Something happens there anyway. Something that is potentially transcendental. And this is what I feel isn't happening in American Cosmic or Whitley Strieb or spirit, you know, the spiritual marketplace, or you know, the vast majority of the cultural artifacts and narratives that are being generated. I mean, it's not in Breaking Bad either. Let's say there are TV shows that we really enjoy and think are good or even great TV, or Mad Men. But they don't have that spark of true compassion, which allows them to transcend the form. And this is my point. This is where I'm getting to with American Cosmic, is that the counterfeit is getting better and better. The art form is becoming more and more state of the art through the technology and through developed skills, learned skills of communication and stylistics and argumentation and I'm not even sure what to call this, ontologies, no, like, anyway, perspectives, you know, more and more sophisticated perspectives that are able to keep spinning the narrative in such a way that it becomes more and more persuasive. But what exactly is it persuading us of? What exactly is it selling? That's the thing. Now, Deadwood, I'm saying that Deadwood, it might superficially be selling HBO. It is, of course. It's also selling the careers of actors and writers and all the rest who might be complicit and so on and go on to do stuff that really is, you know, compromised, that we might not want any part of. But underneath that, and I'd say primary to that, it's selling, and not even selling, it's giving something that transcends any of those criteria. Something that is wholesome and good. And I guess that's what I hope to do with my books, The Prisoner Infinity. It doesn't say, it's not so much that it exposes this or that, or it provides information that counteracts the myth and all the stuff I attempt to do superficially, I hope it does do, but that's also selling me and Aeon Books and whatever else. I don't promote many writers in this, I don't advocate many, but maybe Freud and Jung and Donald Cowshed. There are other superficial things that are being endorsed and emphasized by that work that, you know, probably are compromised too. I mean, certainly would be, including me, or especially me. But what I hope happens with Prisoner Infinity, as with Deadwood, is that there's a transmission that it communicates that isn't dependent on or confined to any of those forms. It's a delivery device for something, and that is the psychological healing through the discovery of a deeper compassion in myself, for Whitley Strieber, for sufferers of abuse and so on. A healing that came about through the literary process of creating that. I don't get any of that from American Cosmic. I get a narrative that's a counterfeit of that. So it's superficially, it's ostensibly, it is advocating these things, it's selling these things that apparently seem, they can't be anything but benign, but the medium is not consistent with the message. It's incongruent with the message. And so we're being sold, I think, a dodgy bill of goods under the guise of, you know, a genuine, honest transaction. And how do we, what do we do with that? Right? Where do we take that? How do we gauge for ourselves whether the transaction is honest or not? That's what I don't know how to communicate. That's what I mean, I can only communicate on a case-by-case basis, and even there I have to say, well, Deadwood might not be for you. American Cosmic may work for you. I can communicate the ways in which Deadwood could work for you, or that you could find something similar in other shows, because if it's there in Deadwood, it must be there in other shows. It's just that it's stronger in Deadwood, and or there's more affinity in myself, so I can identify it more easily. We're all different in that regard. So then it's about, yeah, so then I can identify, this is what I see as transmitting the meaningful value in Deadwood, and this is what's transmitting the counterfeit in American Cosmic. And then you can take that away, and maybe you'll still find something of value there in American Cosmic, but at least you'll be better equipped to identify the counterfeit if you've seen the ways in which the narrative has been compromised.
And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse.
There's a man going round taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up at the terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup, or disappear into the potter's ground when the man comes around? Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big cattle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Till Armageddon, no shalom, no shalom. Then the father hen will call his chickens home. The wise men will bow down before the throne, and at his feet they'll cast their golden crown when the man comes around. Whoever is unjust, let him be unjust still. Whoever is righteous, let him be righteous still. Whoever is filthy, let him be filthy still. Listen to the words long written now. When the man comes around, hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing, multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum, voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wigs. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the priest. In major hundredth weight and penny pound. When the man comes around.
And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed him.
Okay, so I see from the comments, thanks to Martin, that apparently the man known only as Tyler D in American Cosmic has been identified on Reddit as Timothy Taylor, Timothy E. Taylor. This was back in February, and it seems to have been confirmations. Obviously, I've just found this now, so I haven't looked into it, but it seems to have been confirmed in different places. I didn't find anything about Timothy Taylor in the last 3 minutes online, barely at all, besides a few facts about him being a NASA vet page here. I think he's written a book. Yeah, he has, Launch Fever, An Entrepreneur's Journey. So it's not as though he's entirely invisible, but I couldn't find any pictures of him online. Doesn't have a wiki page, etc. Or I didn't find it. And according to this Reddit thread, Diana Pasulka herself explained that the Invisibles are bracing for their identities to be revealed and that they participated in the book knowing this would happen eventually. They wanted us to connect the dots, and here we are. Yes, I'm sure they did want that. Of course, that makes an orchestrated disclosure event much more persuasive if the target audience, TA and PSYOP manuals, is lured into participating in the disclosure itself, if it feels as though it's joining the dots rather than simply being presented with the finished picture, then it's not only going to be much more invested in the story, it's going to be much more likely to believe it, because it feels as though its own efforts, our own efforts of are what has uncovered it, rather evocative of the recent decriminalization of psilocybin in Denver, that people are celebrating not just because they think it's a good idea that psilocybin be decriminalized, which I've never questioned. I don't really believe in criminalization per se of anything, because I don't believe in governments, never mind government interference, but also the idea that somehow it was the government responding to pressure from the people, so it was a victory for the people. Well, anyway, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole again, but I'd say that's another example of how people are fooled into believing something they shouldn't. They should know better than to believe by becoming complicit with it, the way that it actually comes about. And of course they feel, well, they are complicit, so they're definitely more invested in believing it's a good thing and that it's true, because to the extent that they were already lured into that belief, they've helped to make it real. And that's very central to what's happening now with the disclosure. It's an event that is being partially or even primarily generated through our own belief. And I don't mean that in a quasi-quantum indeterminacy way, although I'm not ruling out that aspect too. But there's a weird kind of mindfuck going on now, which is that by being presented with the idea that something is only as real as we believe it to be, like the UFO and the alien presence, that our own belief is the means by which it's becoming real, rather than making us more suspicious of it, that in our postmodernist time makes us more ready to embrace it, I think, because then we feel like, well, I created it, I co-created it, so it must be good. We don't have to feel the powerlessness and the humility of submitting to an objective reality in the old religious sense. We'll still be submitting. That's the tragic, ironic paradox. We're submitting to a state-manufactured deception, albeit one that was cunning and clever enough, but also had no choice but to use the fuel of our own attention, awareness, and belief in order to manifest itself, and to let us in on that, so that A, we would be fooled, we would be more likely to believe it because it's acknowledging its unreality, like the guru who says, "Don't trust me, trust yourself." I lost the thread there. What was I saying? See what a mindfuck it is? We're more inclined to believe it because we're being told not to believe it, but also we're being given the credit for it. Anyway, I don't want to repeat myself. I'm going to refer to this piece that I'm working on now. One line only. You only get one line. Which reminds me to see if something else. Remind myself to talk about that too. Area 51, this book that I just heard about. Anyway, here's the line. The UFO myth entails the construction of an interpretation of an unknown phenomenon that makes it possible to counterfeit it. Even this is confusingly circular, because the construction of an interpretation of an unknown phenomena itself is a kind of counterfeit. It's a constructed interpretation. So it's giving us it's like in a cooking show. They show you all the moves and then they just present the thing as if you've cooked it yourself. You don't really know that dish that's being produced was produced by the same methods we just saw on the cooking show. And if you were to taste it and say, that was great, you would believe that all the moves you'd just been shown were what made that dish that you just tasted. But that's unverifiable, because they don't show the actual process of it being cooked. They skip that and go right to the pre-prepared object. So if you have a pre-prepared meal, in fact, which is what Northern Dairies, Northern Foods were pioneers of, prepackaged meals, Marks and Spencer's. Oh my God, there's so many layers to this. If you pre-prepare an interpretation of a phenomena that someone has only just begun to experience, or perhaps even hasn't yet experienced, even if you apparently show them the way you've prepared it, but you don't actually show the preparation, the full preparation, which is what Pasulka's doing, then that's a counterfeit. First, right off the bat. It's not our interpretation. It's one that's pre-prepared for us, that we've accepted out of a kind of trust in the evidence of our senses, even though we're being told not to trust them. So that's creating cognitive dissonance, which is gradually impairing. There's my cat Tuco's coughing up a hairball, impairing our ability to discern or to think rationally, because really telling us you can't think rationally. But the next layer is that if people take that counterfeit, which isn't the counterfeit of the phenomenon itself, it's the counterfeit of the interpretation of the phenomenon, take note. Once they accept that, the counterfeit interpretation itself is configured in such a way that the phenomenon that it's being interpreted, that we will then interpret via that manufactured interpretation, the phenomenon itself can then be counterfeited. Because the criteria that we've been given through this interpretation that are counterfeit are easy to manufacture. So, for example, to give a very obvious example, technology. If we're convinced that the UFO is an advanced form of technology, even if we're saying it's non-physical, or it comes from the divine or interdimensional realm, but still it's a kind of technology that we just aren't advanced enough to recognize as different from magic, then it opens up to the possibility that actually, it opens us up to being deceived by technology. Because if then the phenomenon being described is replicated via human technology and certain awareness, certain elements of it cue us to the fact that, wait, this is technological, that skepticism, that doubt's already been neutralized, because we've already been sold a bill of goods that allows us to transact with something that is purely technological as if it were a manifestation of the divine or the transcendental. That's the leap that they're luring us into making. And we can see this also in the what the bleep do I know, the quantum indeterminacy, the Tao of Physics, Dancing Woolly Masters, Edgar Mitchell, Jeffrey Kripal, all this stuff that's about the materialization of spirituality, about recalibrating the spiritual phenomenon, spiritual experience, in a scientific way that reduces it to material thing, while supposedly raising materiality up to a spiritual dimension. It's not obviously reductionist. If it was, it would just be, you know, bad science. It's not bad science, it's scientism. That's worse than bad science. So it's partially raising up materiality to a psychic dimension, a quasi-spiritual dimension. But by the same token, it's pulling the spiritual down to the purely psychic. Because the psychic, I think, can be explained or interpreted as a subtler kind of physical thing. God surely cannot. God is not synonymous with the information system of the universe. But this is what the counterfeit is presented as an interpretation, that the universe and the human body is an information system equivalent to computers and, you know, the cloud and all that stuff. Therefore it's alive, therefore it's sentient. And that in its fullest manifestation, it's infinite, and therefore it's equivalent to God. And I made an argument similar myself in Matrix Warrior a long, long time ago. So I know the shape of this holographic elephant, of this Trojan horse of technology, religion, UFO, that is being sold to us. And I can't say for sure that it isn't real. I mean, the counterfeit is so closely approximating the reality now, in appearance that I can't say for sure it couldn't be a vehicle for the true thing, because, as I said, the true numinous can come through anything. Can it come through the counterfeit? That's a weird headfuck in itself, because the counterfeit is designed to prevent us from having the experience of the divine by luring us into a simulation of it. That's the end game right there. So for the divine to actually come through the counterfeit would weirdly confound all the plans of the Illumineers, while at the same time proving them right. Their heads would spin like Linda Blair's in The Exorcist until they flew right off like Robin Williams in Baron Munchausen and flew off on a flying disc to Venus, leaving their poor bodies behind as food for the zombie apocalypse. And, well, that's probably literally what's going to happen. Is me being a Tyler Durden and eating while on the telephone. Hopefully you can stand it. I don't really have to do it, but I just felt like it. So where does that put little old me then in this cosmic train wreck or flying saucer crash? On the one hand, more confused than ever, on the other hand, more, not more certain, but more focused than ever, perhaps. Interesting. I mean, maybe more certain about certain things. And maybe less identified with the confusion. The identification of the counterfeit has to go into the subtlest layers, all the way to our mind, because it's our mind that's the original counterfeit, that creates these counterfeits, and that is fooled by the counterfeits. So the nature of the counterfeit is that it creates a simulation of the real in such a way that the mind can't tell the difference, and not only that, that it will be appealing to the mind in a way that the real thing is not. Because the mind can't actually process God, the true transcendent. So it turns it into, not literally, but it creates an interpretation of it that is a universe, a information system universe, interacting with our DNA that includes a multiverse and that includes all kinds of other beings, and beings of light and beings of darkness and all that, and that we're interacting with them and blah-de-blah-de-blah. Now, all that may or may not be happening, but if it is happening, it's not happening in the mind. Whatever's happening in the mind is not it. The mind is just the movie that we make based on intimations of the body, distant echoes of bodily sensation that we've learned to filter out through this process of algorithmic reinterpretation of the infinite into data bytes, crunchy numbers that appear to represent reality but don't. So making our interpretation of reality ever bigger and more cosmic, more convoluted, more epic, more multi-layered isn't necessarily, or I would say, isn't at all the way to have an experience of reality. It's like mind expansion versus mind dissolution. It's the wrong way to go. Anyway, so where does this leave me right now, situated, working on a piece that once again wants to challenge and confront the workers of deceit out there? That's from the gospel. With a counter-argument. It seems like an opportunity. This book is a big success. That pissed me off. I was going to read it anyway, but I read it with more energy, more attention, because I was pissed off by it. And I found the book was much better than I expected, up to a point, and then at a certain point I realized, oh, it's doing the same thing. It's the redux of Kripal's Supernatural and Lavender's Secret Machines, which it doesn't even reference. Way more sophisticated. I'm surprised. It's almost not a quantum leap, but it's a leaps and bounds ahead of those other works. I never read Secret Machines, but I skimmed it. And it's only been a couple of years. So what does that say? It suggests to me that the narrative, the counterfeit, is being, I don't want to say perfected, but it's being polished now. It's reached a level of sophistication and of persuasiveness that it's more or less ready to usher out. Is that the word? Usher out? Anyway, to bring out. And, well, it occurs to me that if I'm right about this, and this intersects with the one thing I got from the Greek that I can't quite let go of, even though I felt like he was not a trustworthy source. And that was that we're in a time now where there will be a narrative of hope being generated that is so profound and so cunning that it's going to fool everybody into believing that we're on the verge of a techno-utopia. He didn't use the term techno-utopia, but he did infer that it would be consistent with the computer engineering and scientific advances and that kind of thing. He didn't mention UFOs either. The main element is this: the idea of a counterfeit, biblically the Antichrist, that's going to convince almost everybody that it's wonderful, leading up to the, well, whatever we're going to call that. I don't want to finish that sentence because obviously it's only going to have a short time and then it's going to be exposed. But those of us who've fallen for it get thrown in the pit along with it, that kind of thing. Not because it's a vengeful God, but because, you know, that's just the nature of the function of the process. But it's just kind of a, I don't know, a great sort of psychosomatic purge, an enema or something. And for the earth, an earth enema. And anyway, it occurred to me that if this is, if there's any truth in this, and that my goal as a communicator is more and more about identifying the counterfeit and sharing the ways in which I've identified it so others can also identify the counterfeits in their life. It's one, there's one global counterfeit, but there are also, perhaps more importantly, the internal counterfeits, you know, the false self, then if I'm right, then less and less people are going to want to listen to me. I mean, I've only got 9 people listening now, so it doesn't mean that they'll just keep going down and then there'll be nobody, but 9 is less than I had on YouTube. It was like 18 or something, and that's partly because YouTube, you can just, I don't know, you're already there, people are already there, and they just want to know, oh, I'll check this guy out. They won't come to Mixlr because they're invested in the superculture and the techno utopia, and they're hanging out there. They're living in a shopping mall. So they've already signed up. There's the Scrouse. They've already signed up for the counterfeit and its countless iterations. And so they're listening to me as just one more variation, one more tune in their iPod to enjoy, one more cultural artifact. That represents, you know, that allows them to align with and be complicit with the counterfeit, to keep drinking the Kool-Aid. So if what I do keeps telling them, actually, no, this is not what you want to be doing, then, well, they could stop listening for 2 reasons. One, because they know I'm right, and they really act on it in a way that's quite committed and just say, well, okay, so I'll stop using technology at all. And I'm not saying that, of course, but they could go there. Or they'll just say, well, I don't want to hear this. Well, they won't say that, but they'll have an internal reaction against hearing a possible truth. And so they'll stop listening for that reason. However, those reasons are kind of obvious and superficial. So I'm going to present another one, which is in the letter, an email that I got this week from Zach, who's an old participant in Sweater, which I think is not incompatible or mutually exclusive with what I just said, but I think it's definitely more nuanced. So what he said, I have an idea from my perspective about why you're so marginalized. The lack of people following throughout the years could be that your output is too dynamic. Explanation: I came to your work originally through conspiracies. If I would have been a nuts and bolts guy, I wouldn't have been able to follow you into the material covered in Lucid View and Homo Serpians. I don't know why, that's pretty conspiracy. But yeah, I see, if it'd been nuts and bolts. Had I not been going through a process, stormy weather into Warty Theorems and Sweater talk would possibly have driven me out. Now, had I not been going through my own process, the change from stormy weather to Warty Theorems and the Sweater talk would possibly have driven me out. Yes, it certainly did. People lost interest. Stormy weather has still been my most successful enterprise, I think. Feels like it. Obviously, I'm giving a brief explanation just to describe what I mean by saying too dynamic. I found in my own life that once I started going in the direction of conspiracies, I lost some friends. When I went beyond and into the depths, I lost more. Like, yeah, presumably the conspiracy friends, maybe that you'd made after you lost the other ones. Not so much because they did not like what I was doing, but because they could no longer relate to me, and what we used to have in common had gone up in vapors, leaving a strange alienation. My political stance is untenable for all invested in the system, and it's problematic for them to not have a sounding board that repeats and reinforces what they think. Right, so if my creative projects are all part of a personal process of becoming conscious in my own life of who I am, I don't want to say individuation because then that's all nested in a whole complex created by Carl Jung, but anyway, a process similar to what he referred to as individuation, which is the discovery of who we are independently of social, cultural, familial, ideological, religious, etc. Identifications, then I can't be consistent, because that's a process of going through layers, shedding layers of delusion. And as I go through the layers of delusion, I'm exploring the configuration or the elements of those delusions, just as I did with Prisoner Infinity. So that appeals to a certain demographic because they're in a similar layer of delusion. But it doesn't oblige them to pass through that layer to the next. And even if they do, their next layer of delusion probably won't be the same as my next layer. So I move from Strieber to Crowley and organized abuse. Well, maybe there were some people in the UFO kind of audience cult who, I don't think there were, but let's say, who might have been interested in Strieber and really digging deep there, but they wouldn't have wanted to carry on into Aleister Crowley and organized abuse. Seems not scenes about movies, people are into movies and not, and so on. I mean, it's just a much more obvious way in which there's a problem there of being too dynamic. So I'm not really getting to the crux of it here, but it probably has to do with following a thread that isn't in the mind but is in outside the mind, and going places that I've never gone before, which apparently by definition, although there may be presumption, there's are places that most other people haven't gone before, and therefore that they don't want to go. Going places that we don't want to go, because we're compelled to go there, is like having a dynamic relationship to the information universe in such a way that we're not actually following the information. We're using the information as a means to become aware of something that isn't information. Not really. That's the best I can put it. It's not very well put, but it does seem to be a movement away from the global village, the collective. The collective is becoming more and more consolidated through technology, and so it's becoming embedded in and even equivalent to a technological network, an AI superstructure, which I believe the alien contact disclosure thing is going to be the capstone of that pyramid. It's going to be the thing that is presented to humanity as the animating force of the technology. The artificial intelligence is the alien invasion. So we will believe it from both sides. Geek rapture is Christian rapture is alien rapture. Insofar as we can feel that we co-created it, But at the same time, it's not just technology. It is a higher authority, a greater wisdom, but a non-human one. As we've rejected over the recent years, the whole idea of human authority. No more mansplaining. That leaves a vacuum for supermansplaining. For the articulation of the alien intelligence, AI. And so that's the collective village super grid structure of, you know, 5G, internet, smartphones, smart cities, all that stuff we're seeing coming into form more and more rapidly, which is inseparable from the deep fake, from the way that we can less and less trust our senses, not just because the technology is generating fake news simulations of reality, but because internally we're more and more colonized by the technology. So we're beginning to confuse our own memory senses with the media that's coming through the technology. We're wearing Google glasses, literally and figuratively. Google colored glasses. Seeing the world through Google glasses. So my trajectory is away from the mind, which is the false implant, which is represented externally, globally, by the artificial intelligence and the fake alien, the superego alien thing, away from the mind into the body, which is nature. And nature not as some information system, not in some pantheistic, animistic worship way. It's not that kind of nature either, because that's the counterfeit co-ops that too. I was just telling Whitley Strieber talk about how the sun was intelligent light and you connect to the sun. He does those body meditations every day. He's all about the senses of the body, but it's something else. It's so that he can develop his energy body and fly into infinity with it. So, and that's the mind again. It's the mind trying to shackle the body to its own designs. It's just a more sophisticated and spiritualized version of transhumanism. Anyway, so I was winding up now, so obviously this is a very big subject and I could keep going, but I was trying to wind up in terms of the rather specific mundane aspect. My own personal journey narrative. As a voice in the wilderness who wants to communicate what I've seen about the nature and the complexity and the insidious pervasiveness of the counterfeit, whether it's psilocybin or whether it's AI or whether it's the UFO or whether it's quasi-spirituality or occultism or, you know, all these different variations on the same deep fake. Wanting to communicate that, to help others find their way through and through this maze. To help myself by helping others. But how would that help me to help others? The answer is that it's a way to connect others who are seeing what I'm seeing. So they can help me see. We can see together. We can move through it together. And there's not many of us. There could not possibly be many of us if I'm right. Because the counterfeit is so convincing. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe everything's wonderful and it's really going to all pan out, play out beautifully, and there never was a God except for us. I kind of do believe that in a way, and we create the technology and so on, so we're all just becoming conscious through this weird literalization of something that reduces the transcendent to the purely immanent. But I don't think I am, because none of this is eternal. None of these forms that are being presented to us as vehicles for the divine are eternal any more than the human body is. So why do we have to, why is it that we're only being introduced to a physical experience of the divine through technology and through these elaborate quasi-spiritual narratives of ubermenschian endowment, instead of simply checking in with our body and feeling our heart and our blood pulse and the earth beneath our feet? Why isn't that enough? That's the image of God right there. Everything else is noise on top of that signal. But the noise has become so deafening, but also creepily, so apparently harmonious, that it seems like a very powerful, profound signal coming to us from the heavens. But I don't buy it. I absolutely do not buy it. This is not Gabriel's trumpet blast. It's a big, fat, old transhumanist fart. And it stinks.
You serve soul, the soft shell, the porous morons like me, and you're not sorry. Slipper shell, and you can go to hell.
guess you don't. I guess you don't. I guess you don't. I guess you don't.